Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Senate Democrats want a critical victory in the fight to revamp the American healthcare system, but enactment of the sweeping legislation many lawmakers and citizens want is far from certain. Critics fear the Senate's proposal is too costly and overly burdensome. Joining me in the studio to talk about the legislation now up for full debate on the Senate floor, Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief for Health Affairs, and Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Of course, we welcome your questions, comments. Throughout the hour, these are three people who really know what's in that sausage-making process that's up there in the Senate. So do call us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, and I'm sure you've all had quite a weekend. Susan, tell us what's in this health care proposal crafted by Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid.
Well, to boil it down to the most understandable a short description, Diane, essentially what is in place in the bill is an effort to stretch the existing modes that we have of insurance coverage in the U.S. a little bit farther all the way along, so that, for example, for those who have employer-based coverage, essentially there's not an employer mandate in this bill as distinct from the House bill, which did have a strong employer mandate, but there is essentially a mechanism that would discourage employers from not covering their employees. Then we create a whole new series of mechanisms to allow people who do not have coverage now to buy insurance coverage through new state-based health insurance exchanges. There could also be a federal exchange, but primarily the thrust of the Senate bill is that there would be new state-based health insurance exchanges. There would be a series of health insurance reforms put in place to make that coverage more accessible for people and, for example, prevent people or insurance companies from imposing pre-existing conditions on folks. There would be a series of subsidies made available for people, scaled up depending on their income levels, to help afford buying this new coverage through these insurance exchanges. For people who are at 133% of the federal poverty level, that's about $30,000 for a family of four, there would be new mechanisms so that many, many more people would be able to qualify for Medicaid coverage, which is a program, of course, jointly financed through the federal government and the states. In order to pay for all of this, there would be a series of revenue provisions, essentially saving money in Medicare by paying providers less than would be expected. There would be new taxes imposed, particularly on high-income taxpayers who would be paying more payroll taxes under Medicare. There would be a Cadillac health insurance tax, et cetera, et cetera. So you put this all together, these various mechanisms get stretched, these various pools of money get raided, and essentially at the end of a 10-year period, close to 94% of legal residents in the country would be covered.
Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief for Health Affairs and on-air analyst on health issues for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. Turning to you, Mary Agnes, explain the Senate plan's public option.
It would allow states to opt out if they wanted to. It would have negotiated rates with doctors and hospitals and other Medicare providers. But there's a lot of concern among some of the moderates still about allowing states to opt out. They're worried that a public plan might be troublesome for the current health insurance companies. They, for example, Ben Nelson, who's a Democrat of Nebraska, wants states to be able to opt in. Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat, an independent of Connecticut, has said that he doesn't like the public option. He thinks it will harm the current employer-based health care system. So while we did have this vote to proceed to debate on the bill, the public option is going to be front and center in that debate.
And Julie Robner, you were there as this vote went down. Talk about what you saw and heard.
It was interesting. I think this is one of the most, you know, I've been covering the Hill for almost 25 years now. This was maybe the most remarkable procedural vote I ever saw. Remember, this was technically a vote on the motion to invoke cloture on the motion to proceed to a bill. And yet, when the vote actually came, it was a few minutes early, just before 8 o'clock on Saturday night, all the senators were sitting in their seats. And, you know, usually they just mill around and they call the names and people will just either raise their hands or they'll just walk over and tell the clerk. It's very hard to sort of chart a Senate vote if you're sitting in the gallery trying to see who's voting which way. But in this case, it was like, as Senator Rockefeller said to me afterwards, I thought we were impeaching a judge, because usually it's only during impeachment votes that senators are required to sit at their seats and as the roll is called, stand up and, you know, say their vote aloud. But that's what happened during this vote, that each senator was sitting at his or her seat and they called the roll and each senator would stand up and vote. I mean, it was a remarkable vote. I mean, it really underscored how serious this debate has gotten. And remember, this was merely the vote to get to the debate on this bill. So this is a really, really, really big deal.
On this public option, the House approach is very different from that of the Senate.
It is, although it's not as different as it would have been. Remember, the House started out with what they called the robust public option, and that would have been a public option that was tied to Medicare rates. And the Blue Dogs, the fiscal conservatives in the House, rebelled. Oddly enough, or ironically, I guess, in this case, they were worried that in their states, in their districts, Medicare rates were lower, so they didn't really want them tied to Medicare rates. Their hospitals and doctors were concerned about that. So even though that would have saved more money, they actually wanted them. They wanted those rates to be negotiated. So actually, the payment mechanisms for the public option in the House and the Senate will be similar, and those will ironically save a little bit less money. But so the big difference is really this opt-out. There's no opt-out in the House, and there is in the Senate.
How big a hurdle is this public option likely to be?
Huge. It's definitive now in the case of the Senate, because we have senators who've said they, in the case of Senator Lieberman, independent from Connecticut, that he'll vote for nothing that has any public option in it. The only hope of bringing on board Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican, to vote is if the Senate goes with her trigger approach, which is essentially is a complicated mechanism that would create a nonprofit new insurance entity that would be offered in states, but only if 95% of people do not have access to affordable coverage as defined by a complicated formula.
In that state.
Uh-huh. So in essence, the only way to get to 60 votes is to decide whether you're going to go with a trigger that brings on Olympia Snowe, whether you're going to go with nothing, in which case then you bring on Lieberman, or the latest proposal, Senator Ben Nelson, is let's have an opt-in plan
for the
state.
What does that mean?
Essentially, it would mean that a state could vote to enter some kind of a public plan. We don't have a proposal on paper yet, so it's hard to describe, but he has, in essence, described this principle of having states opt in.
And then you have the latest twist, which is Bernie Sanders, the independent, of course, from Vermont, has said he won't vote for a bill unless it has a public option in it. So what he's saying is exactly the opposite of Joe Lieberman, who says he won't vote for a bill that does have a public option, in fact, might be willing to join the Republicans in a filibuster. And Sanders says, well, I'm not going to vote for a bill that doesn't have it. So you've now got the two independents basically saying exactly the opposite things. Now, I should point out, before everyone runs screaming and saying no chance for a health bill, we had exactly the same situation during the Medicare prescription drug bill back in 2003. We had, I think it was 40-some Republicans saying they wouldn't vote for a bill. I'm trying to remember exactly what the issue was. It was one of the cost containment issues. But you had enough Republicans who'd signed on to opposite letters saying we won't have a bill that does this, and we won't vote for a bill unless it does this, and the enough members to sink the bill, saying we won't vote for the bill unless it does that. And in the end, a bill did pass, barely, but it did pass. So we've seen these kinds of threats before. And in the end, sometimes there can be enough compromise for something to happen. So remember, this debate hasn't technically begun yet. So you see lots of these, you know, rhetorical flourishes. In the end, compromise is the art of politics.
And it won't begin until after Thanksgiving, correct,
Mary? That's right. Yes. The Monday after Thanksgiving, they'll move to the bill. Then we should begin to see the sort of amendments that Republicans and Democrats and independents may want to place on the bill.
Give me some examples. Susan talked about cost cutting, but give me some examples of how much money could be raised from certain provisions over a decade, for example, a tax on high-end health insurance plans.
Well, I think the actual number on that was higher before they changed the thresholds, but I want to say that that is now at about the $150 billion range over the next decade, for example. There's reductions in Medicare, how you pay Medicare Advantage plans, the private insurers, and Medicare, the reduction in what's called disproportionate share payments in Medicare and Medicaid. The thought is as more people are insured, there'll be less uncompensated care. Those Medicare provisions in both bills are in the ballpark of around $400 billion over
but
the next decade.
But let me understand, does that mean that individual elderly patients would be paying more for Medicare, or their doctors would be reimbursed less?
Well, how they pay, they've got to deal with the Medicare physician payment. That's a different issue. But the thought is that they want to try to trim, cut waste and abuse and changes in how they make payment, that it shouldn't affect the individual beneficiary. But the exception, I think, on that is Medicare Advantage. Because if they reduce payments to Medicare Advantage plans, they have said they might reduce some of the additional benefits they've given to seniors.
And Medicare Advantage is what you buy as an individual after you have the government Medicare plan.
You could actually pick traditional fee-for-service, or you pick a Medicare Advantage plan, which has all of those services included.
Mary Agnes Carey, she's with Kaiser Health News. Julie Robner with NPR. Susan Dentzer of Health Affairs. Short break and right back. Welcome back. And as you all know by now, Democrats won a critical victory in the fight over health care and revamping the system. The vote went down strictly along party lines. We're talking about what's in that plan now that it is able to be debated, a debate which will begin after Thanksgiving. Here in the studio, Susan Dentzer of Health Affairs, Julie Robner of NPR, Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Julie, during the break, you were talking about some of the whoppers that came out over the weekend. Tell me about those.
Well, certainly the Republicans have been trying to derail this this bill, sort of strangle it in the crib, if you will, and particularly talking about Medicare. And there's been a lot of concern among seniors who, of course, vote in disproportionately large numbers in midterm elections about what this bill would do to Medicare. And it is indeed complicated because a lot of the funding for the bill does come out from reducing Medicare expenditures. But, of course, there are how you reduce Medicare. And there are a lot of health economists who are disappointed, in fact, because the bill doesn't do as much as they would have hoped to what they call bend the health spending curve. Because if you actually find ways to lower Medicare spending in a way that could lead the private sector, find ways to really change the incentives in how doctors and hospitals and other healthcare providers are paid, and that could be copied by the private sector, you could really do a lot to help, you know, bend this cost curve and really set the whole economy on a better track going forward. There's not enough of that, I think economists think, in either the House or the Senate bill. There's a little bit more in the Senate bill than in the House bill. But I think in the Senate bill, one of the things that's been overlooked is that to the extent that you do reduce spending in Part B of the program, that's the outpatient portion of the program, you actually reduce costs for beneficiaries, not raise them, because the premiums that beneficiaries pay are 25% of program costs. So everything you do to reduce the program costs reduce the premium, doesn't raise it. You won't raise costs for seniors. You'll actually reduce them.
Diane, I think a lot of experts are particularly galled with the dichotomy you have on the one hand, people, as Julie says, complaining that the bill costs too much and that the essentially healthcare spending would explode, and on the other hand, critiquing the recommendation of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to change the mammography screening guidelines in order to say that that's an example of government rationing and withholding care. So which is it? Are we spending too much, or should we open up the floodgates and have everybody tested all the time for everything, even if the evidence suggests that we might do otherwise? So you have this inherent tension. Frankly, we experience this as a nation, obviously. We can't make up our minds which way we want to go on this either, and this essentially is a big undercurrent of the current debate.
Mary Agnes, when you think about this, these new guidelines that came in for breast cancer screening and then for pap smears, coming at this particular time created a lot of havoc.
Creates a lot of havoc, but it's, as Susan's talking about, it's, and Julie as well, it's part of this national debate. If we want to use something called comparative effectiveness, for example, research that shows which treatments work best, then you may have to say no to people, or you may have to change the practice of medicine as we've had it so far. And so I think if there is a concern about it's an issue for individuals, and it's an issue as lawmakers look at the healthcare system, how we treat people, how we've done it before, how we need to do it in the future, how we have to control costs, how we use research to its best advantage.
Here's an email we received over the weekend, and it's from Sandy in South Bend, Indiana. Please clarify whether there are proposed cuts to Medicare in the proposed healthcare legislation. There are television commercials running nightly here in South Bend claiming that $4 million, and I think she means billion, dollars will be cut from Medicare by the House bill, and that seniors will not forgive our Representative Donnelly for voting for such cuts. Before the House vote, there was a commercial sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce that objected to cuts in Medicare Advantage, which is an Anthem Blue Cross private insurance program. Would these be the same cuts or additional ones? Julie.
Those are the same cuts. There are indeed, as we mentioned, there are reductions in Medicare spending. They are a big chunk of how this bill would be financed. For the vast majority of seniors, they would not see benefits cuts. In fact, there are benefits increases in the bill. However, the one subset of seniors who might see benefits cuts are people who belong to these Medicare Advantage plans. That's because in 2003, in the Medicare drug bill, the Republicans wanted to give extra money to these private plans who serve Medicare benefits. beneficiaries in order to get more beneficiaries into these private plans.
I see.
And so a lot of seniors are now getting extra benefits, things that Medicare doesn't normally cover, eye care, foot care, Medicare Advantage does indeed get its funding cut, it would be about $150 billion for Medicare Advantage, then probably some of those extra benefits would go away. And those seniors probably would see some benefit reductions. But overall, there wouldn't be benefit reductions from these Medicare reductions.
Susan.
The other important point, though, is it depends on which provision affecting Medicare Advantage plans passes. The House has an out-and-out cut in the payments to Medicare Advantage plans. The Senate would basically institute a new system where these plans would bid against each other. And actually, a lot of entities that are running Medicare Advantage plans say they would live with a competitive bidding situation. And it's not necessarily a given that all of these benefits would be cut in the process. It might be possible to drive down essentially the bids that the Medicare Advantage plans submit and still provide a lot of the benefits. So we have to see which way this plays out.
Mary Agnes, on another aspect of this bill, how would it affect the insurance industry?
Well, the insurance industry would get a lot of new customers. You'd have additional people, millions more people get health insurance, and so they could, and if you qualify based on income, you would get subsidies to help purchase coverage. Now, as we talk about Medicare Advantage, that's sold by private insurers. They may make less money in that market based on these reductions. But the thought is overall, it's a win for them because of the additional customers and the government subsidies that would help people afford coverage.
But wouldn't the insurance companies have to end discriminatory
practices?
That's true.
And that's exactly right. They also would have to end discriminatory practices. They would have to end a practice called rescissions, which is many people, they get sick, they find out their health insurance is being canceled. And so that practice would be stopped. That's exactly correct.
And what about how the bill would affect small business, Susan?
Small businesses would be able, depending on how all of this shakes out, the small businesses would be able to purchase coverage for their workers through insurance exchanges under certain provisions of the legislation. They would get tax credits that would help support the provision of insurance to their workers, and basically some other mechanisms that would essentially more or less make it easier for them to access coverage, not the least of them being these insurance market reforms that we talked about, which would take away some of the real problems in the small business, small group health insurance market.
Do I understand correctly that companies with more than 50 full-time workers that do not offer coverage would pay a fee as high as $750 multiplied by the size of the workforce?
That would be if your worker received some subsidy help, help from the government to purchase insurance. That would be in the Senate bill.
But there are also tax credits for small employers.
Yes, there's a very deliberate attempt to incentivize small businesses to offer coverage.
What happened in this debate over the federal antitrust exemption for health insurers, Julie?
Well, we hear that it was taken out of the Senate bill at the request or the insistence, if you will, of Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who, of course, was one of those last three holdouts whose vote was being very much courted. Those last three, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, who were three members who very much don't like the public option and who were very much on the fence about becoming those 60th votes or the 58th, 59th, and 60th, if you will. And he very much did not like the antitrust exemption. Now, I would point out that antitrust exemption for insurance companies, which has been in law since 1945, a lot of the experts I've talked to have said that it really doesn't do that much. It's
really
not the real reason for the fact that there's so much consolidation in the health insurance industry. So I'm not sure that that's such a huge loss to the bill.
Okay. Let's talk about what Mary Landrieu gained in the process.
She gained a lot of help for the state of Louisiana. In very brief terms, essentially what happened is after Hurricane Katrina, so much federal funding was poured into the state that, at least on paper, Louisiana temporarily became a richer state. And that affected the Medicaid formula under which Medicaid is jointly paid for by the states and the federal government. The states get a match for the money that they put up from the federal government. Because Louisiana was temporarily a richer state, basically that match changed. And in 2011, when that money is gone, the state is poor, the relationship changes. Essentially, the state would get much less in federal funding. So what she got, in effect, was a provision where, beginning in 2011, the state gets extra federal funding to run its Medicaid program. And on paper, that's going to be somewhere between $100 million and $300 million over 2011 and beyond.
Was there a lot of flack on this, or was this something that Harry Reid just had to do to get her vote?
He essentially had to do it. All of this became about dialing for dollars at a certain point, and that was her price of coming on board.
Okay, so you've got Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas. You've got Joe Lieberman. How much of this support is likely to hold as we go forward, Julie?
Well, if you watch the Sunday talk shows yesterday, not very much. I mean, they all said in their speeches that they're going to vote. They would vote to let the debate begin, but changes had to be made in order for them to vote. You know, they'll need 60 votes again at the end to break the filibuster on the bill. And they all announced right then that they're voting now, but they're not promising anything going forward. But
I would imagine you're going to see lots of television ads blasting this bill. Am I wrong, Mary Agnes?
No, you're not. I mean, we've had a lot before now. We'll have even more. I mean, I think along with all the Christmas shopping ads, you're going to have all sorts of ads on both sides of this debate, and it's going to be nonstop.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We haven't talked about abortion, Susan. How much of an issue that's going to play out here?
Clearly, it will also be huge. I would say that plus the immigration debate will continue and are not over.
Talk about the immigration debate as well.
Well, on immigration, the issue has come down to: Will we decide to let illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants, buy insurance with their own money through new health insurance exchanges, or will we wall that off so they cannot buy it? There's no other assistance to undocumented immigrants in any of these bills. And keep in mind, we have probably somewhere between 12 million and 20 million of them. So they would get no other assistance. They would get potentially the ability to buy coverage on their own dime through these exchanges, except there are many, particularly in the Republican parties, but also some Democrats who don't want any undocumented immigrant to get any benefit whatsoever out of the legislation.
And the abortion question is equally complicated, Julie.
Oh, indeed it is. Remember, in the House, they passed the STUPAC amendment, as it's now known, which would basically say there will be no federal funds of any sort, not just in the public plan that would be created, but also within these exchanges, any plan that gets any money that through these subsidies will not be able to offer abortion as a benefit. And therefore, there are insurance experts that say that basically, since so many of the plans that get offered will have money coming through in subsidies, that the impact of that will be that there basically will probably not be plans in the exchange that will offer abortion, that they'll end up just simply by virtue of administrative complexity, end up simply offering plants that don't have abortion in them.
And I think it's important to point out, we're not just talking about health care. We're talking about the shape of the Senate and the House. We're talking about elections coming up in 2010 and how this health care debate is going to play out there, Mary Agnes.
Well, of course, for President Obama, health care legislation was a cornerstone of his campaign.
Key.
Same thing for many Democrats who campaigned for the House and the Senate. You mentioned the 2010 elections. The pressure of those elections is putting a lot of pressure now on lawmakers, and the White House is putting that pressure as well to get this bill passed and to do it well ahead of those elections. Now, whether that means you have to It seems like it's very hard right now to finish the entire process by Christmas. Again, the Senate has not passed a bill yet. The House has a bill. Those two would have to be reconciled. Both chambers would have to pass those final bills before they went to the Senate, the White House, rather, for the president's signature. But now we're talking, there's some discussion about whether it might be a bill, if in fact the Senate passed one and they're reconciled, perhaps by State of the Union. I know some of my colleagues are suggesting
Valentine's Day.
So it's going to be a really tough haul, but they want this very much.
You know, it's interesting because, as you said, Mary Agnes, President Obama, as candidate, Obama put so much stress on this, and yet he then turned the whole thing over to the Congress. Is he going to be far more active in this debate as the Senate moves forward than he has been so far? Susan?
Well, I think behind the scenes, the White House has been extremely active, and the president himself has been making calls, even on his recent trip to Asia. So nobody should be gulled into thinking there isn't a very active Obama administration presence in this discussion. I think he will begin to speak out on specific issues, particularly if log jams are beginning to develop over issues like the public plan and so forth.
He's already tapped former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who, of course, was the failed nominee to head the Department of Health and Human Services over some tax issues. But former Senator Daschle is already now an unpaid consultant working behind the scenes with the Senate Democrats.
Julie Robner of NPR, Susan Dancer of Health Affairs, Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. When we come back, it's your turn. We'll open the phones. We'll take your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The past, present, and future of books. How the digital revolution and electronic books will change the marketplace of ideas. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And on the healthcare debate, here's our first email from Cliff in Texas. He says, I keep missing one thing over the last several months. What is the Republican plan? All I hear is they don't like what the Democrats are coming up with. Do they or did they have a plan, or are they just being obstructive. Susan.
Well, the House Republicans have put out a plan of sorts, although we have to say that it was sufficiently sketchy that the Congressional Budget Office couldn't really even score it and said so in its letter telling them what they thought it would cost. Essentially, that plan in particular would pull together a bunch of things that the Republicans have been traditionally in favor of, for example, having so-called association health plans, having essentially the ability of different
co-ops
organizations together.
And
the like. Well, a variation on that theme. In addition, some other provisions, malpractice reforms that they have wanted for many, many years, et cetera. But it doesn't. It didn't really hang together as a huge plan, certainly as contrasted with the Democratic plans. On the Senate side, there is no single Senate Republican plan. To the degree that you have individual senators who've endorsed various other measures, including a bill that Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has put forward, along with Senator Bennett of Utah, Republican. But there really is no sort of monolithic Senate Republican plan.
So is Cliff drawing the right conclusion? Are they simply being obstructive?
Well, certainly Senator McConnell, you know, pointed out that yes, when they were in charge, because he was asked this several times over the weekend, you know, you were in charge of – the Republicans were in charge of the House, Senate, and the White House for 6 years. Why were you not doing this? And he said, well, we tried, but we didn't have the votes, which – true, they didn't have 60 votes, but they had pretty close to it. But indeed, they really did – this was not a big priority for the Republicans when they were in charge. I might point out that the bill that the Republicans put up on the House floor, the Congressional Budget Office said, would cover about 3 million more people compared to the 30-some million in both the Democrats' House and Senate.
Mary Agnes.
I think philosophically there's a big divide between the parties. Republicans want, as we're talking about, very small approaches to take small steps. They feel that the Democrats' plan is too big and too comprehensive. But on the other hand, Democrats say, look, you need to look at this system in its entirety. You don't want to undermine the employer-based system. But yet we need to stop problems like not covering a pre-existing medical condition or stopping insurance once people have it. We need to help people afford coverage, and that perhaps if we get more people covered, that would be a very good step for all Americans, including those who have insurance.
All right, let's open the phones. First to Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Fred. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for your time this morning and your discussion. I appreciate it.
Good.
I'm interested in, a couple of things. One is I don't think anybody in the country has any interest in health insurance itself. What all of us want is health care. The health insurance industry is a gateway. And as you try to go through that gateway, now I have health insurance. But the first thing that happens is a filter of what I would simplify to saying rationing. And I really would like to see those people find other employment. Now, the president has actually been asked this sort of a question. I recall hearing it at a news conference. And he simply said, I can't let that many people who represent that large an employment of the United States, I can't simply cut them loose. I'd like to see them cut loose, but over whatever amount of time it takes to get them to find other useful employment.
Fred, what you're saying is, if I understand you correctly, is you'd like to see the health insurance companies disappear.
Absolutely.
Okay, Susan.
I think the important thing to say here is that the health insurance industry in this country has undergone a lot of evolution in recent years. And many of the large insurers have evolved from organizations that were just traditionally selling insurance and then denying claims, moved and developed more into companies that really feel that they have an expertise at helping to manage health care utilization and manage health care costs effectively. Fact of the matter is that the way we pay health healthcare providers in this country. We give everybody an incentive to do everything all the time. And the medical evidence base is pretty thin, so that essentially we have a system in this country where the incentives are, if you walk into a doctor's office, the doctor's incentivized to do as much for you as possible, except for his or her professional obligations not to overtreat you or kill you. So insurers can come into that equation and say, look, the evidence suggests that if you do this, it's going to cost a lot and not obtain any benefit. And so as the industry evolves into this and wants very much to continue to evolve that way, it has perhaps a more useful function to perform than at any time in the past.
And that's why this committee report was so controversial about mammograms and the other one about pap smears.
Well, that's true. Of course, this committee was a committee of doctors. They weren't affiliated with the insurance industry either. They weren't technically affiliated with the government. They weren't technically affiliated with the insurance industry. In fact, they had a mandate to not look at costs. They had a mandate to only look at the science and at the evidence.
The outcomes.
But to build on what Susan was saying, the other thing that the insurance industry has really evolved into doing is to figure out how to coordinate care. And this is something that really these bills are looking into doing. It's to bring together not just doctors, because right now healthcare is a cottage industry. We really have, you know, we have hospitals here and doctors there and other types of healthcare providers. And the one thing that the insurance industry has really started to do, because it's a way of being more cost effective, is bring together all kinds of healthcare professionals. I mean, they've really developed this idea of disease management, of finding ways, if you have a chronic disease, to bring in different kinds of people with expertise, not necessarily always doctors. And that's something, that's a real, you know, value you add that the insurance industry can bring. So it's not that there isn't a place for the insurance industry. The idea behind these bills is to take out some of the abuses that the insurance industry has been practicing, but not get rid of the insurance industry.
All right. Let's go to Rolling Prairie, Indiana. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
My question is, I would like to know why it is that our legislators can find a way to turn over $900 billion a year to our Department of Defense to discover new and better ways to destroy people, yet there is a hue and cry from many of them over spending $900 billion over a 10-year period to help the people of this country.
Interesting question, sort of putting the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the expenditures there up against health care, which presumably is to help people stay well.
I think this triggers a national discussion that's happening with voters. It's happening with lawmakers. It's happening all over the country. Is the what do we want health care to be in this country? Is it a right? Do we want people to have a medical bankruptcy over their health insurance? Do we want people to not receive care because they don't have health insurance? Yet how do you craft a bill that, we're talking about the health insurance industry a moment ago, strikes the proper balance between what the health insurance industry has done well and what it has not done well? But I think the type of federal expenditures, whether or not we take the step at this point, is part of the debate.
And to Owen here in Washington, D.C., good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to redirect the conversation back to a little bit of what all of your commentators have talked about, and that is the cost issue. And it seems to me this has evolved from a discussion about health care reform to health insurance reform, and that in both the House and Senate bills, there are some very modest down payments on health care reform of the delivery system. And I guess one of my concerns is that if the existing legislation passes and we expand coverage significantly, which, you know, would be a good thing for the country and for the people who get it, how are we going to sustain those gains over time if we do not more head-on confront our spending issues? And a lot of the anger and ire about healthcare spending has been directed at the insurance companies. And perhaps a bit more of it should be directed toward the providers, because that is actually where the spending is.
Well, Alwyn, as you well know, The bills are filled with references to the secretary shall. And these essentially are charges to the Health and Human Service Secretary, now Kathleen Sebelius, to undertake a whole lot of experiments to figure out new ways to organize health care, particularly under the Medicare program, and new ways to pay providers under the Medicare program. So accountable care organizations, medical homes, other payment innovations, all designed to figure out new ways to provide health care in a more cost-effective way. So a lot of what is going to happen under this legislation, assuming it does pass, is systematic efforts on the part of the government and others over the next decade to figure out how to do this in a better way. So much of this is really going to be in the implementation phase, not anything in particular that is said or set forth in the legislation.
Truly.
You know, every single meeting I've been to, you know, sort of smart people in healthcare for the last 5 or 6 years has come down to this debate. Do you get everybody covered and then figure out how to cut costs, or do you cut costs first before you figure out how to get everybody covered? And there has never, I have never seen a really good sort of, agreement on that point. I think this bill sort of goes the let's get everybody or almost everybody covered and then figure out how to cut costs. The idea is, you get everybody on the boat first and then you figure out how to do it.
All right. 10 to Dallas, Texas. Hi there, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hey, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got a question about the legislative process. It looks like the Senate may not be able to pass a bill with any kind of public option. And at this point, you've got two very different bills, one in the House, one in the Senate, and they go to conference committee. And I'd like to ask your panel or yourself, if you know, one, do we know which members of Congress are going to be on the conference committee? And my next question is, how different can that bill be from either one of the of the House or the Senate bill? And I guess ultimately, could the conference committee come up with a bill that has a public option that would then simply go back to the House and the Senate, respectively, and be able to be passed by a simple majority?
Mary Agnes.
Well, there's a long, long road to that conference product. And I think that, for example, your first question, who's on the conference committee? We don't know yet, but typically it is the chairs of the committee of jurisdiction. Max Baucus, for example, a Democrat of Montana, head of the Finance Committee. Tom Harkin is now head of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. But I would assume Chris Dodd, who ushered the debate through in late Senator Kennedy's illness and subsequent passing, he would probably want to be on that conference committee. In the House, you've got from the Ways and Means Committee, Energy and Commerce, and Education and Labor. Those members would certainly be on that committee. The conference committee can, of course, would look at the products, the bills that were passed by the House and the Senate, but they could well come back with a bill with a public option that could be different than what the House or the Senate passed. The key is all about the votes. Can that conference report get the votes in both chambers?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Fred in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. He says, why do we have to invent yet another new government program to provide health care for people under age 65 when it would be so much easier to open Medicare enrollment to all Americans? Those who can afford the premiums would pay the actuarially determined rate for their age group. Those with low incomes could be subsidized based on their net income level. Medicare is a known entity by citizens and healthcare providers. Julie.
You know, I think this actually goes back to the earlier question about, why is it that that the government can spend $900 billion on wars and not think about it, and yet, $900 billion on health care. Really, the debate between the Democrats and the Republicans is all about the extent to which the government will be involved in health care. And this is another, this has been suggested about having people buy into Medicare. It's actually been suggested about having people buy into Medicare early, that perhaps people over age 50 for whom buying private insurance is very expensive because they are actuarially more expensive. They're more likely to need medical care. And every time it tends to be rejected because the idea of more government involvement in health care, government takeover of health care, a phrase we must have heard, every 15 minutes.
And that's what we're going to hear a lot more
about. We're going to hear a lot more of it. And that's, I think, what the debate is really about. The Democrats are perfectly happy with more government involvement in health care. The Republicans really don't want it. And that's really, I think, where the country divides, too, is to what extent is it the government's responsibility to ensure people have health insurance? And that's really the big split when you get down to it. And that's what the fight over the public option is about. I mean, it's really, is it the market or is it the government? And, you know, right now, if you look at the health care system that we have, it is a hybrid system. It's almost half and half at this point about how much is public money and how much is private money. And it's pretty dysfunctional. And the question is, where is that balance going to end up? And I think so this question and the earlier question go to the same part of that debate.
And here's an email from Jerry Ann O'Fallon, Missouri, in regard to abortion. Has any other legal procedure been excluded from health care? How can this happen based on the beliefs of a minority? Susan.
To my knowledge, there is nothing else in the bill that amounts to a medical procedure, or the bill, any of the bills, that has been fenced off. The only thing I guess you could say comes close to it is in the Senate bill now there is a 5% tax on cosmetic surgery, which arguably would disincentivize the provision of cosmetic surgery, but it doesn't disallow it. So abortion is unfortunately has a unique role
so
in this debate.
So that's going to be a big part of this fight as this goes forward, Mary Agnes?
Absolutely. I think we talked earlier about the House bill. The Senate bill has a different provision on abortion. It would say it would absolutely say no public money used to fund abortion, but it would say in the exchanges, plans that provide abortion services, at least one plan would have to be available, as well as a plan that did not provide it.
So your prediction as to when and if, Mary Agnes, this goes forward? I'm talking about the whole
right.
Senate.
I mean, abortion, yes, will consistently – the Senate language does not go as far as the House language, but it's going to be a flashpoint as they complete the bill.
And, Julie, you're saying we'll have something by Valentine's Day.
That's what I think.
And is that your prediction as well, Susan?
I do – I concur with that. I think they're going to pass something, but it will be a very, very long haul.
Susan Dancer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. Julie Robner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.